From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how Abe Lincoln turned his political rivals into allies and cabinet members. We talk with historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her new book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. Also, Mike Wallace looks back on his career, including his old radio show, Mike and Buff. Buff was his wife. Wallace has a new memoir called Between You and Me. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this election day, we're going to talk about the political genius of Abraham Lincoln, who brought into his cabinet three powerful men who had politically opposed him. My guest, historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, has written a new book called Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. She writes, "In my own effort to illuminate the character and career of Abraham Lincoln, I've coupled the account of his life with the stories of the remarkable men who were his rivals for the 1860 Republican presidential nomination, New York Senator William H. Seward, Ohio Governor Salmon P. Chase, and Missouri's distinguished elder statesman Edward Bates." Lincoln appointed Seward Secretary of State, Chase Secretary of the Treasury, and Bates Attorney General. Doris Kearns Goodwin won a Pulitzer Prize for her book No Ordinary Time about Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt, and has also written books about Lyndon Johnson and the Kennedys. Doris Kearns Goodwin, welcome back to Fresh Air. Your book is called Team of Rivals, and it focuses on cabinet members who were his rivals, who actually wanted the nomination for president from the Republican Party. Why would he choose his rivals to be in his cabinet?
I mean, it seemed at the time an unprecedented act because people hadn't done that in previous years. And these men were not only his rivals, but they were so much better known than he was. Seward had been the governor and senator from New York. He was so much considered the possibility of being the person who would win the nomination that 10,000 people were waiting outside his home in Auburn to celebrate. The champagne had already been stocked in the local restaurants. And he thought when he was made Secretary of State that he would actually run the show and Lincoln would be just simply some sort of puppet. But in fact, Seward and he ended up becoming great friends. I think Lincoln had an internal confidence that even though these men thought they should have been president, similarly Chase of Ohio thought he should have been president, Bates of Missouri, an elder statesman, Stanton, who eventually becomes Secretary of War, had humiliated Lincoln once when they were young lawyers together, but he was able to put those past rivalries beside him, knowing that if these guys do a good job, then it will only be down to the interest of the country and obviously to his own interest as well. And it meant that he had to have much more than they realized, a sense, I think I can handle these guys. I can master them. And he did.
What do you think Lincoln did to bring together this cabinet of rivals?
Well, what he had going for him, which I think is so unusual in political life, is that he had a set of emotional strengths that today we might call emotional intelligence. So when all sorts of rivalries sprung up with these guys, and when they got hurt with one another, when they would call each other names, I mean, if we ever heard what they were calling each other then in today's parlance, liar, traitor, thief, I mean, and these things are being said in cabinet meetings, but he was somehow able to be in the center of that storm. When one of their feelings would be hurt, he'd be able to write a letter saying, if I hurt you in any way, I did not mean to do so. Forgive me for things that I might do hastily. When he was upset with somebody, he would write what he called a hot letter, where he would write it all down, and then he would put it aside until his emotions cooled down, and then write, never sent, never signed. And there was a sense about him where he was just kind and sensitive to them. If one of them was feeling he was spending too much time with another one, he would call that one aside and give him a special time to walk together or to go on a carriage ride together. So what he essentially did is what a great politician does, which is to understand that human relationships are at the core of political success. And he somehow managed these people who, as I say, oftentimes hated one another, wouldn't even go into the same room with each other after a while. Stanton and Blair, his postmaster general and his secretary of war, said such terrible things about each other that Blair would never even go to the War Department, even though he wanted to find out what was going on in the battles. It's almost unimaginable that he was able to keep this group together, but the success in keeping it together meant they also represented very different spectrums of political opinion, from very conservative to moderate to radical. And as long as he could keep that coalition together by keeping these people inside the tent, he was actually keeping those strands in the country together as well.
What was considered radical then?
Well, what was considered radical then was the idea that early on you wanted to make emancipation the central focus of the war. And then later on, even after emancipation was made the focus, the radicals were more desiring to make the South pay for having gotten us into this war in their judgment and to wreak vengeance on them in order to be able to make sure that the old social structure would not come back in the South. Whereas the conservatives were thinking that the Union was more important than emancipation. And also at the end of the war, they wanted to make sure that the South came back in a more gentle way so that the Union would be preserved, even if it meant not punishing the leaders of the South who had been part of the Confederate cause.
And where did Lincoln stand?
Well, Lincoln stood in the middle on all these things. I mean, naturally in the middle, not because he was positioning himself in the middle. At the start of the war, he thought that the Union was the most important thing, and that emancipation, he wasn't sure, was something that he as president could do anything about, much as he might have wanted to, because it was in the Constitution protected. So he thought the most important thing was to get a constitutional amendment to eradicate it, which he eventually did. But by the middle of the war, he came to understand that as president, he would have powers as commander-in-chief when a military necessity was at issue to be able to do something about the slaves. And the slaves were being used to help the South. They were digging the trenches. They were acting as cooks. They were protecting the home front when those soldiers went off to war. And they just unbalanced, gave so much benefit to the Confederacy as opposed to the North, that he finally was able to decide legalistically that if he issued a cry for the emancipation as a military necessity, he would have that power to do it. Eventually, you'd need a constitutional amendment. So he moved toward what might have been the radical side. On the issue of Reconstruction, I think even by the time of his death, however, he did not want to have vengeance against the South, but he would have been worried about protecting the rights of blacks, which they were also worried about, so he probably would have been in the middle on that ground as well.
What did he do to hold together this group of people within the cabinet who had such differing views about what the fate of the South should be and what emancipation should look like?
Well, I think partly what he did was to move step by step toward emancipation. You know, just as Franklin Roosevelt moved step by step toward getting us more involved in World War II, even before Pearl Harbor, by Lend-Lease, by the peacetime draft, Lincoln began to move toward certain steps that would allow the Army, for example, if slaves came into the Army camp, to take them into the camp and keep them protected from the Southern slave owners. And these steps allowed him to move some of the conservative members to see, well, we did that, and it didn't produce some sort of race war, because the conservatives were always afraid if you emancipated, there'd be this incredible servile war in the South, so that it got them accustomed to the idea. And finally, however, the interesting thing is when he finally made the decision to emancipate the slaves, he called his cabinet together, and he told them, I want to tell you what I've decided, and I will listen to your comments, but I want you to know I've made this decision. I think he finally knew that if he put it up to a vote or a discussion, then it might make it harder for these people to understand that this was his decision. And the only thing he did was he accepted their thoughts on the style of it. He accepted Seward's advice that he not issue it. He was going to issue it in the summer of 1862, and the war was going very badly for the North. And Seward said he thought it would look like he was just desperate and that it wasn't an act of considered opinion. Why not wait for a victory to issue it? And Lincoln took that into consideration, agreed with Seward, and waited until the Battle of Antietam was fought and successfully resolved before he finally said he was going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So I guess in some ways what it meant was he listened to them as he was going along, but he finally had to decide for himself what he was going to do and then just tell the cabinet in a very forceful way, this is what I'm going to do. I'd like you to think about it, but it's my decision.
What happened to these cabinet members that you write about, the team of rivals, after Lincoln was assassinated?
Oh, it's so interesting what happens to them. I mean, first of all, Chase is one of the more interesting pieces of the story. He was one of the few cabinet members who never did accept Lincoln's primacy. So even in 1863 and 1864, he was plotting to run against Lincoln for that second nomination so that he could beat Lincoln and become the president. Lincoln knew everything he was doing. He was aware. Lincoln had incredible tentacles, so he knew what was going on. But he somehow kept him inside the tent rather than letting him go outside. And then finally Chase did resign from the office of Secretary of Treasury. He had embarrassed himself in many ways so much because it became known what he was doing against Lincoln. But then in the fall of 1864, after Lincoln had won the election, he appointed Chase to the vacancy that arose in the Supreme Court when the Chief Justice died, giving him the highest position on the Supreme Court, even though he said, I'd rather swallow a chair than do this to Chase, who he didn't like. But he knew that Chase, who was an abolitionist, would be the best protector for the rights of the newly freed slaves.
Well, William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wasn't he shot during the assassination?
You know, I hadn't fully realized what happened to William Seward. During the assassination attempt, John Wilkes Booth really had a triple assassination in mind. He wanted to get Seward, the Secretary of State. He wanted to get Andrew Johnson, the Vice President, and, of course, Lincoln. So he took Lincoln on for himself. The person who was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson chickened out and didn't go to Johnson's hotel. But the man who was assigned to Seward went to Seward's house at Lafayette Park, and he managed to get inside. Seward had had a carriage accident about a week and a half before, and his jaw had been broken. He was up in a bed, so he pretended he was bringing medicine up to Seward. But Seward's son understood that something was wrong as he barreled up the stairs and tried to stop him. He then took the blunt end of a revolver and hit Seward's son, who was his assistant secretary of state, on the head so badly that he was in a coma for days. He then took out a knife and slashed two or three other people, came into the room, slashed Seward's entire cheek off, and just happened to miss the artery that would have killed him. And he then ran out and slashed another couple people on the way out. So it was one of these extraordinary moments in Seward's family life. And, however, he somehow managed to pull through. And, in fact, his son also came out of the coma and pulled through. And the incredibly sad thing was that his wife, Frances Seward, who was torn apart by the thought that she was losing her son and her husband, was so tense. And she wrote an article in which she said, "I've never before believed in vicarious suffering, but I think somehow that my son and my husband are getting well, and I've taken their suffering onto myself." And in May, only a month or so later, she died, and no one knew quite what she had died from, and she was not an old woman. So that the Seward family was forever broken by that event. But the part I think that got to me the most emotionally was that they didn't want to tell Seward that Lincoln had been killed, knowing how close friends they were. So they kept the news from him, but finally he looked out the window, and he saw the flag at half-mast, and he turned around. He said, "I know Lincoln is dead." They tried to say, "No, no, that's not true." He said, "I know he's dead. If he were alive, he would have been the first one here to see me after my knife attack." And then great tears coursed down his cheeks, and he knew then his chief was dead.
My guest is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called Team of Rivals. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Doris Kearns Goodwin. Her new book is called Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. A recent book about Lincoln says that he was gay or bisexual. I haven't actually read the book, so I confess. So I'm not sure which it asserts, but have you reached any conclusions about the president's sexual orientation?
Well, you know, one of the great things about the comparative perspective is when you see something like somebody claiming that Lincoln was gay, you can look at what the evidence is and look at it in relationship to all these other guys as well. For example, it is said that because he slept in a bed with his best friend Joshua Speed for 3 years, that that's one indicator of the possibility that he was gay. They also point to letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, which were quite affectionate and full of a feeling, of intense feeling. But if those are the measures, then almost all my guys, as I sometimes call these cabinet members, would be looked at as being gay, because it was very common for men to sleep in beds together. In fact, when Lincoln was on the circuit in Illinois, they would all travel around the state together, the judge and the bailiffs and the criminals sometimes and the lawyers, and they'd stay in the same boarding houses where there weren't enough beds. So sometimes two or three lawyers would be in a bed together. The only one who got his own bed was the judge, because he weighed over 300 pounds, so no one could be there with him. And then when I looked at the affectionate letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, his friend, they were nowhere near the intensity of some of the other letters that I found. For example, when two of his cabinet members, Chase and Stanton, were young men in their 30s, they had both lost their wives and were very lonely and became very close friends. And I found these letters that Stanton wrote to Chase at the time saying, "Since our pleasant intercourse last summer, no one has been on my mind more waking and sleeping. I dream of you at night. I can't wait to sit by the fire and hold your hand and tell you I love you." Similarly, Seward, when he was in the state senate in New York, formed a friendship with another senator who wrote to him saying, "I have positively womanish feelings for you. I miss you when you're not here. This is not the right thing for a grave senator to be talking about. I do not think any charges were ever made or any thoughts that these other men were gay. And I think that just means that men were more free in that age to express their deep feelings for one another. There was very little friendship between men and women because women were so chaperoned, so that women and women formed very close friendship. Men and men formed close friendships. And I think it was just an age where I wish almost we had it today, where men could really express those feelings as openly as they could then. But I don't think that we can imply from that that sexual contact or sexual intimacy was the end result of those letters or the sleeping in the same bed.
Now that we know so much more about depression than we used to, historians are starting to examine how, you know, depression may have affected important figures, including Lincoln. Do you have any new thoughts about what you describe as, melancholy temperament and how that affected him as a leader?
I came away feeling that rather than suffering from chronic depression, that Lincoln did have a melancholy temperament from the time he was born. There's a writer named Jerry Kagan who studied children from the ages of 0 to 20 and argues if you look at them even 3 months, 6 months old, you can divide them into whether or not they have a melancholy or a sanguine kind of optimistic temperament. And clearly, I think Lincoln had that melancholy temperament. But he also had enormous resources all the way along to figure out how to get himself out of his sad moods, humor being one of them, conversation. During the Civil War, he would go to the play when he wanted to. He went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War, if not more. He would go to the battlefront when he felt sad over the loss of a battle to talk to the soldiers. He had an acute awareness, I think, of his own needs. And except for two depressions, which we know about, one when his first love, Anne Rutledge, died, which it's natural for somebody to fall into a depression. And secondly, there were a series of events that took place when he was in his 30s. His best friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving town. His political career had suffered a blow, and he had broken his engagement to Mary Todd Lincoln. And he really did feel overwhelmed then by depression. And we have letters that he wrote saying that he was the most miserable man on earth, and that if everybody felt like he did, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. And he actually was so frightening to his friends that they removed all razors and scissors from his room, fearing that he might take his life. But his best friend, Joshua Speed, came to his side and said, "Lincoln, if you do not rally, you will die." And he said, "I would just as soon die now, but I haven't done anything yet to be remembered by." He had this dream from the time he was young that he was so fearful of just dying and turning to dust, that somehow if he could accomplish something great, this is the way the Greeks used to think, your name would be remembered after you die. And that powered him through the early losses of his childhood. It powered him through his early days in the state legislature, and it helped get him out of this depression. And the great thing is that many years later, when he finally signed the Emancipation Proclamation, Joshua Speed came to see him, and he said, "Well, Speed, remember that conversation we had when I was in my depths? Well, maybe at last my fondest wish has been realized. I will be remembered after I die."
My guest is historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, and her new book is called Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. This is your first book published after the charges that you had plagiarized passages in a couple of your books. Is this kind of like a reemergence for you now?
Well, you know, the fact is that, I mean, for the last 3 years, I've been out talking in lectures and been finishing the book. I've been on television. So it's only when I talk to people about book that it seems like I haven't been running around all this time. And the other fact is, of course, that this whole event took place nearly 20 years ago. And at the time that it took place, I acknowledged that errors had been made. I made the corrections in the subsequent edition and made them to the satisfaction of the author. And then when it came back up again 3 years later, I acknowledged it once more. So there's nothing else that one can do except to make absolutely sure that those errors will not take place again. Even though I had credited the author every step along the way in the past, the quote marks in some places were in the wrong places. I've made absolutely sure that everything is right. So it feels very much like it's behind me. And interestingly, it has been. I mean, when I talk to audiences, there's not a single question asked about it. But I understand that journalists will every now and then ask a question, and I'm fully prepared to answer.
So has this whole incident changed your approach at all?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is when it was going on, and so it might have seemed like it was preoccupying my life because it was in the newspapers, at that same time, two events were happening in my family which were really much more important. My husband had been working for 10 years on a play about Galileo and Pope Urban VIII, and it was put on in England. And we went over there for 3 months, and it was one of the happiest times of our life because the play was so successful and it meant so much to him. And at the same time, our youngest son, Joey, had graduated from Harvard in history and literature in the spring of 2001, and after September 11th joined the Army. So he went to basic training to officer's candidate school and then was sent to Iraq. So he was a platoon leader for a year in Iraq during that period of time some years ago. And he luckily got out safely, but I was thinking a lot more about him during that period of time. He eventually won a Bronze Star. And those are the events in your private life. This was a piece of it. I'd been lucky enough before this to have, you know, a lot of wonderful things said about me in the press. Hopefully that will continue to happen now. And that's simply what it was a press story because the situation had all been taken care of so many years before.
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are so welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
Doris Kearns Goodwin is the author of the new book, Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mike Wallace looks back on his career as a tough interviewer and tells us about some of the shows he did before he started doing interviews. He has a new memoir called Between You and Me. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Wallace is famous for the two-fisted interview style that he developed on 60 Minutes. In his new memoir, Between You and Me, he writes about some of his most dramatic interviews. An accompanying DVD features excerpts of those interviews, like this one with Malcolm X, which Wallace did for the CBS Morning News in 1964, after Malcolm X had become disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad's leadership of the black Muslims.
Do you feel, perhaps, that you should now take over the leadership of the black Muslims?
No, I have no desire to take over the leadership of the black Muslims, and I have never had that desire. But I do have this desire. I have a desire to see the Afro-American in this country get the human rights that are his due to make a complete human being.
Are you the least bit afraid of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
8 months after that interview, Malcolm X was assassinated. In 1975, Mike Wallace interviewed Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent who guarded President Kennedy when he was assassinated. Hill had retired shortly before the interview was recorded, but you can hear that he's still devastated.
Can I take you back to November 22nd, 1963? You were on the fender of the Secret Service car, right behind President Kennedy's car. At the first shot, you ran forward and jumped on the back of the president's car in less than 2 seconds, pulling Mrs. Kennedy down into her seat, protecting her. Well, first of all, she was out on the trunk of that car.
She was out of the back seat of that car. Not a lot of trunk of that car.
Well, she had climbed out of the back, and she was on the way back, right?
And because of the fact that her husband's part of her husband's head had been shot off and gone off to the street.
She wasn't trying to climb out of the car. She was...
No. She was simply trying to reach that head, part of the head.
To bring it back.
That's the only thing.
Was there anything that the Secret Service or that Clint Hill could have done to keep that from happening?
Clint Hill, yes.
Clint Hill, yes? What do you mean?
If he had reacted about 5/10 of a second faster, or maybe a second faster, I wouldn't be here today.
You mean you would have gotten there and you would have taken the shot?
The third shot, yes, sir.
And that would have been all right with you?
That would have been fine with me.
That's an excerpt of the DVD accompanying Mike Wallace's new book. Wallace has been with 60 Minutes since the show's inception in 1968. Although he's 87 and has retired from full-time participation in the show, he still does some segments for it. Let's go to the very beginning of your career. Your initial goal was to be a radio announcer?
That's correct. And I was turned down in Muskegon, Michigan. When I got out of Ann Arbor, where I went to school, University of Michigan, and as a result, I eventually auditioned at WOOD in Grand Rapids, and the program manager hired me for $20 a week, and I was in heaven. And that's what launched it all. All I wanted to be with that time was a radio announcer.
Well, what was your job when you first got the job as radio announcer?
Well, as a radio announcer, I read, rip, and read news.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't a reporter. I was reading The Wire. And the other thing was, I was reading commercials, and I could do a hell of a commercial. And I did exceedingly well. I used to announce The Green Hornet Rides Again, or The Challenge of the Yukon, or... Occasionally, I was the announcer on The Lone Ranger.
Locally or nationally, like for the national show?
Nationally, out of Detroit. WXYZ in Detroit, Michigan.
So you would take us to those thrilling days of yesteryear?
That's exactly right. And I was good friends with Brace Beamer, who was the man who played The Lone Ranger, and took it very seriously.
Did you work on your voice in those days? Did you take voice lessons or,
you know,
try to deepen it?
I've not thought about this forever. Louise Hannon was a speech teacher at the University of Michigan. And she used to put her, she said, here's how to produce a proper voice. And she put her hand on my belly and on my back. And she said, the voice is supposed... I didn't know what was on her mind, really. she said, look, produce your voice from down here. And she pressed my belly. And the fact of the matter is, that's how I learned to develop a voice. And it became a kind of distinctive voice. And particularly when there's not too much phlegm down there, it remains at the age of 87 a voice that's worth listening to.
Now, in 1949, under the name Myron Wallace, you hosted a program called Majority Rules. What was the show?
It was a quiz show. It was...
This was still radio?
This was radio. Well, it was not television. Bergen, Dr. Bergen Evans, who was a professor of English at Northwestern University, was the star of the show. And I was the moderator. And he would have a variety of I forget exactly what. Can you imagine? You're just a child, so you don't have the problem that I have.
I'm still in my crib. Yeah.
At the age of 87, I swear it's astonishing how much I have forgotten and cannot remember.
Well, let me ask you about that, actually, because I think that the issue of memory is such an interesting issue, particularly for someone who's either a historian or a journalist, because part of what you've devoted your life to is recording. I mean, what you've devoted your life to is recording things, recording people, talking about events that have shaped their lives or the world. And you have that on history, and some of that history is in your book and in the accompanying DVD. But then, of course, in your own mind, like the rest of us, the mind and the memory, they're imperfect. So you've recorded all these things, but then you start to forget them.
Yes, I know.
So does it make you think that... That memory, that like tape and DVDs are great, but that memory is futile because eventually you start forgetting all those things you worked so hard to remember.
Look, to reach for a name, to reach for an event. I had a fall. I fell off a jetty out in Martha's Vineyard and landed on my head. And I was standing and slipped. And it was brutal. And bloody, and I woke up. I don't know how long I was out, but that really, I'm convinced, had something to do with losing my memory. When you have that kind of a blow to the head, I hate to think about it. It really does something to your memory, and then you add age to that, and then you begin to hear less and see double. You're a very fortunate person to be how old?
Me? Let's do the math. 54.
You're 54?
Mm-hmm.
You got the voice it's a beautiful voice.
Oh, well, thank you.
And at least 25 years younger than that.
So when was this fall?
It was 2-3 summers ago.
Mm-hmm.
But, really?
But you're still doing some work on 60 Minutes, right?
Yes. I have two profiles coming up on 60 Minutes. And, you know, I'm down to doing maybe half a dozen, 8 pieces a year, because I've been there for, 36, 37 years. Harry Reasoner and I started it along with Don Hewitt back in 1968.
Now, let me get back to your early career. Test that memory a little bit. Shows that you hosted included Majority Rules, Guess Again, All Around the Town, and Mike and Buff. They sound like great shows. So these were all these were all radio?
Well, Mike and Buff was radio and television.
Oh, it was so good they simulcast it.
No. We did it on CBS in the afternoons on the radio, and then they decided, hey, why don't we put the two of them? Buff was my wife.
Oh.
Back then.
Oh.
And what we did was, one of the characteristics of the show was that we were the Bickersons, in that we used to bicker about things on the air that people found entertaining. The kind of back and forth that used to go on husband and wife shows back then. Unfortunately for us, the bickering that was on the air eventually turned real. And so after a while, the bickering continued at home. And so eventually, we bickered ourselves
out of a job.
And a marriage.
That's correct.
My guest is Mike Wallace. His new memoir is called Between You and Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Wallace. He has a new memoir called Between You and Me. It comes with a DVD that includes excerpts of the interviews he writes about. You started off doing quiz shows, you did some acting, announcing, commercials. You eventually get to 60 Minutes and become...
We're
missing a lot here, yeah.
Yeah, what happened was I didn't feel that I was properly earning my keep. I used to say, look, I do these commercials and I do this drama and this sort of thing and the rip and read news, and I was doing the air edition of the Chicago Sun and the air edition of the Chicago Sun Times after a while and so forth. I wanted to be more legitimate. I got interested in, obviously I had been interested in news, and what happened was that I lost a son. He fell off a mountain in Greece. His name was Peter. Wonderful boy. Good writer. Wanted to be a reporter. And I used to say back then, look, I said, well, I have to do these things because I have kids to support. And that was my excuse for doing stuff that I was not particularly proud of doing. I mean, I made a good, honest living, but I was not. So I said, I'm going to quit everything. I have enough money to live for a year, probably at the same, in the same standard of living and so forth, and see if I cannot get a job doing news exclusively. Forget quiz shows. Forget drama and all of that stuff. Do news. Be a reporter. And, of course, it was a chance that I took, and it's the best chance I ever took, obviously. Because that was, I was 38 years old when that happened.
When 60 Minutes started?
No.
It was before 60 Minutes, okay.
It was before 60 Minutes.
Oh, this is Nightbeat and the Mike Wallace show, right.
That's correct.
Right. No, so you became famous for interviews. On your own shows,
right.
And
I was anonymous prior. I was anonymous prior to Nightbeat, which was on a local television show here in New York, on Channel 5, and all of a sudden it became a New York hit. You know, New York is supposed to be a unwelcoming town, a tough town. Not true.
Now, let me ask you. I've heard like transcriptions, you know, like old recordings of radio interviews from the 1930s, and maybe from the early 1940s, and they're basically scripted. You can hear the interviewer and interviewee literally reading scripts.
That's true.
Right, and so when you started doing broadcast interviews, did you have models? Had you heard unscripted interviews, broadcast interviews?
I had not really heard. No. To that degree, I and the people I work with, a fellow by the name of Ted Yates, particularly, who was the my partner, the producer, we decided we were going to ask tough questions, abrasive questions. We were going to do a lot of research, and we were going to do it live on the air. I had an 11 o'clock newscast. And then what happened was we continued for another half hour after the 11 o'clock newscast on television, and all of a sudden New York fell in love with it. And it was astonishing. This person, me, who was anonymous, suddenly became, hey, Mike, go get him.
One of the things you've become best known for in your 60 Minutes interviews is, you know, is not only the tough interview, but the what's been described as the ambush interview, where the camera person walks in with the camera running, and mm-hmm. and the person doesn't want to be interviewed, but the cameraman's mm-hmm. there with the camera on, and you see the person waving the camera away and putting their hands over their heads, putting their hands in front of their faces so that no one can see who they are, and you're asking questions even though they're trying to get rid of you. Have you ever had any reservations about that kind of interview? Have you ever thought that there's anything unethical about it? Yeah, go ahead.
I didn't think at the time that it was unethical. No. I mean, come on. I'm a reporter. You can't subpoena people to talk to you. If you write to them and try to call them on the phone and they don't answer and so forth, then take them unawares. The problem became this. We became a caricature of ourselves. We were after light, and it began to look as though we were after heat. Not to reveal some information or not to find out the story.
It turns into
the
drama
theater.
It turns into
theater.
It
was good theater. Uh-huh. It was good theater. But after a while, it became kind of predictable. And so finally, both Don Hewitt and I said, hey, enough of this. This is foolishness, Don being the producer of 60 Minutes. This is foolishness. And so we gave it up and have not. I still think it's a perfectly legitimate device to take somebody unaware and say, hey, there's a question that you ought to answer. There's a question you should answer. Matter of fact, maybe I'll, of course, there'll be Secret Service men around, but maybe I'll do that with Dick Cheney.
Have you asked nicely yet?
Well, I have asked nicely. I have interviewed every president. I haven't interviewed many vice presidents, but I've interviewed every president since Abe Lincoln, with the exception of George W. Bush.
Yes, you say in your book that Karl Rove has never let you interview George W. Bush, even when George W. Bush was governor of Texas.
That's correct.
So why do you think that Karl Rove is standing between you and President Bush?
I was doing a piece down in Texas when he was governor about tort reform. And Karl Rove, who was his strategist, decided that we were not going to be... that it was going to be difficult for him to answer some of our questions. And so he said, no, you're not going to, Mr. Wallace, it was Mr. Rove and Mr. Wallace, you're not going to see the governor. He's not going to talk to you, simple as that. So we went ahead and did the piece and so forth, and then when he was finally elected president, we figured, well, come on, now he's president. Well, you know the White House and how secretive it is, how stonewalling it is, and since he's been president, I've tried and tried and tried. Fact of the matter is, I have never met the president of the United States. I interviewed his dad.
My guest is Mike Wallace. His new memoir is called Between You and Me. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Wallace. He has a new memoir called Between You and Me. It comes with a DVD that includes excerpts of the interviews he writes about. You have discussed and written about a problem that you've had with depression.
Mm-hmm.
When you realized what it was, did you
mm-hmm.
comprehend it? And I ask this because I think you're about 87 now, right?
And I am going to be 88 next May.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people of your generation didn't grow up, you know, reading Freud and studying psychology and it being, you know, everybody wasn't in psychoanalysis or some kind of therapy. Things have really changed in terms of dealing with psychological issues, and certainly with depression, our understanding of the biochemistry of depression has
right.
changed enormously.
And the genetics.
And know, the genetics of it. Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I find really that a lot of people who are older and who didn't grow up with, you know, like studying psychology, and perhaps you did, don't really understand things like depression that well, you know. Like you're
well,
happy
you know
or you're
something?
Sad, and that's the way life is. And did you get it when you were diagnosed?
When I first began to not be able to eat happily, mm-hmm. or sleep enough, mm-hmm. or whatever, and had pains in my arms, I didn't understand it. I was going through a tough time. I was sitting. Have you ever been sued for libel?
Knock wood. No.
Good. She hasn't. Well. Knock wood for you, because when you're sued for libel...
And this was the Westmoreland case that you're talking about.
That's exactly right. For $120 million, CBS and, among others, me, sued for libel and spent 4 months in a cold and drafty federal courtroom being called liar, cheat, fraud, etc., etc. I mean, that... I didn't realize what was happening. But I was sliding into a depression. My wife said, "Mike, you're depressed." I'm not. And my own doctor said, "No, don't you talk about yourself and depression. It would be bad for your image, Mike." Can you imagine?
Well, let me ask you. You say some people warned you that you couldn't talk publicly about your depression. It would be bad mm-hmm. for your image. And in fact, I mean, your image is of being the really tough questioner. Nothing gets
That's
to
right.
you, and you can ask anything to anyone. And so if
so
people thought that you were vulnerable, that could, in fact, really affect your image. So did it. When you came out as having suffered from depression.
What happened was this.
Yeah.
What happened was this.
Mm-hmm.
1 o'clock, 1:30 in the morning, you remember Bob Costas used to do a show called Later?
Yes.
He wanted to talk to me about 60 Minutes. And I asked him, who watches or who listens at 1:30 in the morning? And he said, well, some people who work at that time, but also people who get to sleep. And I said, oh, my people. and that's... He got so many answers, so many telephone calls, so many people who said, hey, that's what's going on with me. And you mean to say that Wallace, who apparently is doing his job and was a tough guy and so forth, he's not just a wimp. As a result of that, I figured, I'm going to go public. Of course, by that time, I was fairly well established doing what I do.
Yeah, I'll say. And speaking of doing what you do, you still do what you do, although you do less of it. But you are not quite retired yet. Why not? Why do you still want to be working at an age when most people choose not to?
Because it isn't work, as far as I'm concerned. Because it is fulfilling in all kinds of ways to do what I do. When I get up in the morning and I know that I have an interesting story that I'm working on, and I'm reasonably healthy, but my psychiatrist to whom I go for lube jobs every now and then has told me that... I'm sorry. It's still Dr. Kaplan and Mr. Wallace after 20, 25 years of this. He says, look, You have no overwhelming... You're not going to die right away. So you might as well get used to it. Keep working. Keep working.
Has having a psychiatrist for, what, 25 years, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
Has having been in psychotherapy or seeing a psychiatrist for 25 years taught you anything about interviewing? Because I'm sure your psychiatrist asked you a lot of probing, interesting questions that get you thinking.
Of course it does. You suddenly realize that if you can persuade somebody, as he persuaded me, to talk candidly, and look, your whole life, Terry, the way that you live teaches you, in jobs like yours and mine, I mean, it comes into play because it is useful, because it's part of what you learn as you go. Come on, I'm nearing the end of the road and still learning.
Mike Wallace, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Mike Wallace's new memoir is called Between You and Me. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Alzheimer's Association, advancing research, providing care and support services, and promoting healthy brains at alz.org. And from members of the American Institute of Architects, working to create valuable and sustainable buildings and communities. Good design makes a difference at aia.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd about her new book, Are Men Necessary? When Sexes Collide. And we talk with comic Sarah Silverman about her politically incorrect act. She has a new performance movie called Jesus is Magic. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.